Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive, but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Hey, everybody. It's Pascal. I'm super stoked to be here today with George. George Constantinescu is the Chief Transformation Officer for ATCO, a $20-plus billion company out of Canada, active in manufacturing and the utility space, so energy production. George, you've been in this space for a while. You've been with ATCO before, then went off and did your own things in startups, and then returned to ATCO in this role as a Chief Transformation Officer. And we both know each other for a little while now, had the great pleasure of working together on a couple of occasions. George, how do you define, first of all, great to have you here. Secondly,
wonderful to be here. I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation. Pascal, every conversation with you is an absolute pleasure for me. And it's wonderful to be able to actually have this discussion in front of other people, your friends, your audience. So I'm very flattered to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. We're super grateful to have you. George, let's start off with the slight easy question, the lowball question. Like, how do you even think about disruption? Like, how do you define it in your world? How do you think about it? Probably also the distinction between, if there is one, between innovation and disruption. Talking about the space you're coming from.
Well, I really appreciate the way that you asked the question and the fact that we're starting with definitions, Pascal. One of my observations in this whole world of transformation, innovation, disruption, is that these terms have become so overused in a sense. I think it's possible to have very fulsome conversations without actually realizing that the people having the conversations have completely different understandings of what it is that they mean when they use these terms. So I always think it's helpful to begin with a mutual understanding of what it is that we all mean by these terms. From my standpoint, I think disruption is really very simply something that interrupts the status quo. And it's not really much more than just that. Now, the way that it's typically used in our industry, in our casual conversations, is something that is more monumental than that. It's in terms of sea changes in technologies or sea changes in industries and industries collapsing and new ones replacing them. But I think anything that really impacts the status quo can be, and certainly does feel to the impacted, like very much a disruption. So that's the way that I interpret it. And with respect to innovation, it's interesting. I view disruption as being a decimation of something, in effect. And innovation is a contribution to something. So I suppose they're related in that sense that they're opposites to my mind. And quite often you have an innovation that leads to a decimation of something else. But that's the way that I would interpret them. That's the way that I would define them.
Operating in an industry you operate in, which is more traditional, clearly very CapEx intensive, also an industry which, you know, to some extent, feels like it's going through a lot of change at the moment. If you think about the utility space, of course, as we're going to renewable energy, you know, these probably decentralized networks, etc. How do you approach this from your perspective? Do you drive this? Are you active? Are you an active participant in the market? As a large organization, are you sitting at the sidelines and waiting for it and then pounce on it once you see it? How do you think about this?
Well, it's interesting. I've been in business, and a lot of my time has been in this business for 3.5 decades. So I've seen the constant change or the influences, the factors of change applying to this industry throughout. And because we're talking a bit about it now, and because obviously we're talking about an environment that is more and more driven by what seems to be faster and faster technological progression. And because there are so many other factors that we're contending with, which are considered to be step changes, the whole pandemic, and the much, much more sharpened awareness to environmental realities and things like that. It seems that these are new concepts, but from my experience and my standpoint, these have always been with us. The industry has always had this impetus to evolve. There have always been pressures, technological and otherwise, on the industry to evolve. And in order to have been successful throughout this period of time, adaptation and evolution has been necessary. So it's an extension of that. It's perhaps an extension of an evolutionary process that has been accentuated of late, but it's not something different. And to answer your question directly, the people that, or the entities that actually wait to for change to happen and then react, more often than not, they're the ones that become the victims of disruption. They're the statistics. Quite often you find yourself with an insufficient capacity to react. Once it's become evident to all that a certain trend is there to stay. So from our standpoint, and certainly from my personal standpoint, I think it's very dangerous to follow trends, to look at trends to guide your actions. I'm much more a believer in understanding the fundamentals of your business, and really they go to the fundamentals of your customers and your customers' preferences and what their needs are going to be. And the formulation of a strategy that responds to those underlying factors as opposed to trend following. That seems to be the necessity for remaining relevant in a dynamic environment.
Can you say a little bit more about how you apply this in your space, again, like energy production and distribution? I mean, clearly there's the huge hype, which is, you know, everything goes solar or renewable in generally. Everybody will have their solar panels on their house and we will have decentralized networks and the utilities are gone. Right, that's the one side of the utopian future we some people paint. So it sounds to me that you apply a different lens to that.
It's interesting. I mean, all those conversations tend to lead with solutions, and quite often they lead with solutions that are promoted by proponents or providers of those solutions. What I'm suggesting is that all of those end up to be simplifications, perhaps oversimplifications of the kinds of things that we should be considering, which is really what is the purpose to be served? What do customers and users actually require that power for? And how do they interact with that that need for that energy? And how can that be provided most efficiently? So understanding the fundamental drivers behind the requirements, I think informs what kind of solutions would be best suited. And I think there is a broad range of solutions that are possible. And I don't think they're unitary. I think that's probably what defines the evolution of our industry, is the fact that more options are possible. And therefore, there will be diversity in how these requirements are going to be met. And the big question is how can they be met for the greatest number of people, do the greatest good, the most economical in the most economical way, in a way that is most fair. And if you look at the evolution of the energy systems, they really have come from the same perspective. It's a democratization to access to energy. And the solution thus far has been one of centralized generation and kind of ubiquitous distribution. That's been the model, because that in the past has been the answer of providing the most to the most for the least. And we have technological evolutions which are changing that paradigm a little bit, but fundamentally the problem to be solved is the same. As we've discussed in the past, it's very seldom that the problem to be solved changes. It's just that the means by which you can solve it changes, and that can create a disruptive-like event.
How do you prevent a company from jumping into the solutions phase, or an organization or a team, right? Because it feels to me, I love what you're saying, and it feels to me it's somewhat antithetical to what the practice is for many of us, right? Which is, great, solution, let's do it. You know, and then we figure out how we do the solution best, which you know, gets in prototyping and whatever. I love the going back to the first principles. How do you make sure that you take the company with it? Because it feels much less sexy.
Oh, it is. And it's a lot of hard work, but it's unavoidable. It is one of the critical and most difficult things to actually achieve, the challenges to surmount. And it's interesting because there are a lot of proponents of agility. I'll just use that as an example. And it's usually employed as an abstraction, an absolute abstraction, agility in all things. You can see how that resonates. You know, it's great to do things quickly. One of your great interviews with Chris Yeh was talking about maximizing the rolling of the dice and what have you, and that certainly makes perfect sense. But if you apply it to absolutely everything, like problem solving, like considering what the real question to be asked is, if you apply it in that sense, you really do yourself a disservice. Because some things you really should dwell on. Some things should just take the time. So you need to be judicious in how you spend the time that you have and maximize the time spent on the things that can deliver most benefit and minimize the time spent that, again, maximize the output. I think there's an Einstein quote that says, give me a problem and I'll spend 55 minutes in formulating what the real question is and 5 minutes on the solution or something to that effect. I'm a big believer in that, but it's really difficult to do. And not just in a corporate level, but on a personal level, where we're all chasing instant gratification to a certain extent. We want the quick answer and the reward and moving on. And it's a difficult instinct to fight. And so we need to be disciplined about it. And I suppose if we're talking about a transformational journey, it's instilling that level of discipline in an organization where you actually take the time to consider what it is that the real question is or the real opportunity is, and make sure that when you launch into all these techniques that allow you to pursue a solution, you're launching in a worthwhile direction. So that's part of the journey that I think we're all on, is how do we discipline ourselves enough so that we take the time and do the hard work that it takes to actually figure out what question we should be asking and answering.
That being said, what do you think are the conditions for this to actually happen? As in, I would imagine like you need incentive systems which are aligned with that, which arguably, I guess, in most companies aren't, right? Because most companies are measuring output versus a good chunk of like actually spending time on the inputs, promotions, all that kind of stuff. How do you think about that?
Well, the world kind of revolves around incentives. So we have to create the right incentive structures for people to actually do the things that we want them to do. And you know, there are a lot of examples of people actually wanting to do sort of the right thing, if you want to, for lack of a better definition. But there are incentives built in that prevents them from doing the right thing. So the whole incentive towards the ready solution, and the quick reward, and the project being done, and the reward being kind of given, and then down the road, the consequences are the benefits or lack of benefits of that project are recognized. But by that point in time, it's too late to actually kind of correlate it to the process that actually led to that outcome. And all these things, which are typically well-intentioned within large organizations, the governance structures and the type of gatekeeping processes and the validation steps, a lot of them can be misused or at the very least can lead to unexpectedly negative consequences, particularly if they've been designed from a perspective of from a defensive perspective rather than an opportunistic one. You know, it's a classic example of a successful company kind of retrenching into optimization and into protecting its position and its gain, as opposed to looking opportunistically to grow. And the kinds of governance structures that you put in place in order for that to happen are quite antagonistic to being able to create the next version of yourself, you know, the nascent version of yourself. That's kind of where the rub comes. And the solution is to recognize that and actually make a space for you or part of you to be hungry and creative and opportunistic. So there is a certain separation of activities and of what are considered to be best practices that are necessary in order to be able to do that.
That being said, how do you bring them together in the end? Because this goes a little bit to this, the debate about the, you know, whatever, the core and the edge. It feels to me that there must be a point, clearly there must be a point where you bring them back together. May it be on a per project basis or per initiative basis, but where you graduate the stuff out of the one and bring it into the other, or do you?
You absolutely do. I think on the more opportunistic, the more creative end of things, you have the opportunity to really learn. The practices aren't so well defined, so optimized, and so there's an opportunity for exploration and experimentation, and with that comes learning. And I think it's really important that that perspective is continuously fed back into the core, if you will. We talk about evolution and innovation, and the distinctions people make between incremental innovation and disruptive innovation, for lack of better terms. I think it's really important for the perpetual evolution of even established practices to have this kind of mindset applied to it, to have a learning mindset, but the one that's defined by possibility, even when you think that you've polished the stone as much as it can be polished, you know, to still want to polish it just a little bit more. And I think the skill sets that are necessary for that are learned in this more permissive, more exploratory space. So I think that is how the two are brought together. Now, clearly, if you, in this journey of exploration, if you actually do uncover the next big thing, there's a whole lot of discipline that's necessary to commercialize that. And there is a huge capacity within a well-established, large, and well-funded, I guess, experienced organization in commercialization. So that's a critical segue into kind of actually bringing the benefit that is identified with innovation. I believe there has to be some benefit in order for it to actually qualify as innovation, some commercial benefit or some benefit to an end user. So the commercialization aspect comes back into the operating world, but the skill sets that are necessary for the perpetual evolution of the core are discovered on the edge. So that's the way that I see it. And that's certainly the way that we're practicing it within ATCO. We're trying to establish permissive spaces on the edge of our core businesses where we can explore and learn and take those insights back into the core and ensure that the core is always at its peak evolutionary trajectory. And while doing that, we're ensuring that we're open to any new eureka moments that you can find on the edge, which can then be pursued on their own merits.
Let me ask you, I'm not saying you should say this about, you know, any company you happen to know, but if you were to look at hypothetical big company, what are the red flags when you look at innovation and disruption efforts? And I mean, you've been exposed to a lot, not just inside of ATCO, many other organizations as well. Like, what are the red flags? What is the stuff companies stumble over? What is the things you look out for?
Well, it's quite interesting. And innovation itself has become such a fashionable pursuit, if you will. It seems to be the one hope that we have for solving all our solutions. We'll just innovate our way out of it. So it's almost necessary to be able to demonstrate that you're pursuing innovation in some fashion. And when it's done for its own purposes, to its own ends, I think that very rarely succeeds. I think you can evolve by being innovative. I think that's different. I think innovation as a practice to continually improve and evolve your organization is absolutely the sound pursuit. But standing up an innovation silo within your organization and saying you're ticking that box, that's a red flag for me. And, you know, as an industry, obviously there are a lot of brilliant people that are pursuing this and no dispersion on them, but there's also an element of governments wanting to kind of desperately be seen as doing something, try to do something, throwing money at a problem, and whole ecosystems kind of evolving around this pool of funding that are kind of focused on consuming this pool of funding. So there's this theater of innovation, as I know we've discussed in the past, that evolves around that, where there's very little outcome from it other than just a whole bunch of people having a bunch of things to do funded by these pools of investment that are made in the hope of a low probability kind of bonanza occurring at some point in time. It's a bit of a lottery, if you will. It's a lottery strategy. The government is buying lottery tickets and hoping that there's going to be this boon at the end of it, with, I think, a full understanding that all of these things are quite low probability of success in all startup ventures, as you know.
If you were, as I know you've done now, but if you were to stand up an innovation effort as it is being integrated into the organization, so we're clear, it can't be standing just on its own for the sake of it being innovative. Like, what are the top three, I don't know, like 3, 4, 5 things you would basically immediately do, like on your like checklist? What is the thing you're like, okay, if for this to succeed, here's the things I need to do?
Well, I think the first thing that you need to do is you really need to unleash all the capacity of all the intellectual capacity that's within your organization. So it's really focused on people and culture. And you do that by allowing the people that do have initiatives to bring them forward in a permissive and supportive environment. I think that's step one. You need to unlock people's imaginations, and you need to be able to support them on an exploratory journey. You need to facilitate learning. But as, again, Chris Yeh mentioned, it's very difficult to do that in a didactical sense. It's much more accessible to people to actually gain learning through experience. So you need to facilitate some execution framework that allows them to learn some of these principles by doing. And I think that both encourages and motivates people to actually bring forward their ideas and their energies. I think that's sort of the beginning. And at the core of it, I think there's a need to actually kind of address and respond to real opportunities, in the sense that we need to engage with factual truths, objective truths, if you will. There's your and my favorite saying from Ayn Rand about ignoring reality and not ignoring the consequences, not being able to ignore the consequences of ignoring reality. There's another one from Philip K. Dick, one of my favorite authors, that says reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. I think putting in place practices that make people aware that is an imperative, that you need to do the things that are necessary in order to ensure that your understanding of your environment, your world, your opportunities is factual. It's not a trivial thing. I mean, it sounds self-evident when one says it, but it's a difficult thing. We are all subject and slaves to our own cognitive biases, and figuring out organizationally how we position ourselves to negate the biases that take us away from objective truth is really important. So you know, the project execution frameworks that emphasize diversity of perspective, diversity of experience, and allow that to kind of manifest itself in a supportive and safe environment. I think we've discussed before, a safe environment that emphasizes radical transparency, that emphasizes constructive discourse, that removes the hierarchy from the discussion and kind of focuses on idea meritocracy. All those things are things that really do help create an environment that is conducive to actual effective innovation, to evolution of the organization. So those are some of the things that I would certainly, that I believe are necessary and certainly the things that we're focusing on.
Last question, and I think I know the answer because, George, you come across as a very optimistic person here. If you think about corporations, how confident are you that they can actually innovate, disrupt, stay relevant over long periods of time?
It's an incredibly good question. And it's probably the question, Pascal, from where I'm sitting anyway. I don't think corporations or anybody should actually seek to be disruptive. It seems such a negative term to me. I think people should focus and organizations should focus on establishing sustainable relevance. That should be the objective. It's not to diminish or destroy, it's to enhance. I think it is possible for large corporations to maintain relevance over extended periods of time. I think ATCO as a company is an example of that. We go back over a century on the utility side, well over a century on the utility side, and 75 years on the entrepreneurial side. It is possible to be in the market, to stay in the market, to stay focused on customers and their needs, and to stay relevant. But it's certainly not easy, and it requires a great deal of discipline and awareness. I think the only way in which you can do that is by staying adaptable and fundamentally being innovative. And yes, I am optimistic. I do believe at my heart that it's possible. But there are so many things that work against you, particularly once one has achieved a level of success. It's a part of human psychology that we're more afraid of loss than we aspire to gain. And I guess maybe that goes back to our reptilian brain that says it takes a very short period to die and a long time to actually gain or some version of that. So I think we come by it honestly, but if we become too defensive, if we kind of forget the things that contributed to the success that we enjoy, that's definitely a warning sign to kind of beware, because you do need to retain some of that DNA, some of that entrepreneurial, for lack of a better word, drive that got you to be where you are, because that made you attuned to opportunities. And if you become too self-satisfied and too introspective, then I think it's only a matter of time before you become irrelevant.
George, on those words, there is the perfect ending. Thank you so much. This was really insightful. I love the different perspective you brought to the table. I love the focus on the first principles, on the really truly understanding and unearthing the truth about a market, a situation, a change, and building up from there, which, you know, somewhat flies into the face of a lot of the practices we're seeing out there, of course, which is much more, let's do it, you know, like we take it for granted that X, Y, and Z will happen. Really love the perspective, really love the conversation. So thank you so much for agreeing to be on this little experiment and podcast here with us. And again, thank you so much.
Pleasure as always, Pascal. Thank you.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. Also know that this is part of an effort of us writing a book about disruption. So keep your eyes and ears peeled towards that. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and just like this. There's some weird algorithm thing, which, you know, if you like it, they will like us. So do me a favor, do that. And if you've got any questions, any comments, anyone I should talk to, drop us an email, Easiest email address for me to reach it is p, just the letter p, at finet.com. With that being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.